Well, good evening, everybody. If everybody is settled, I think we probably ought to start. Our lecturer is still sitting in the front row. My name is Tony Giddens, director of the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome Olivier Blanchard here this evening and to welcome the audience. He is professor at MIT, chairman of the department there, one of the world's leading macro economists. Professor Blanchard has long-standing connections with the LSE and, I believe, specifically with the Center for Economic Performance, and we're delighted that he's come to give the Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures. This is the third of these lectures, and its title is, well, I've got a short title, but he's got a longer title. My title is Employment Protection and Unemployment, but he will show you his own longer, more demanding title as soon as he switches on the machine. So, Professor Blanchard, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. This is what the title became when I started thinking hard about the topic. And you'll see that there are two changes. The first one is the word sclerosis here, which will be one of the themes of this lecture, and then a more explicit part about unemployment, namely the effects of shocks on unemployment. Let me, for those of you who were here in the last 2 days or for those of you who were not, let me remind you of the organization of these lectures. In the introduction to the lectures, what I argued is that to understand the evolution of European unemployment, one had to appeal to three factors. The first one was shocks. The second one was changes in institutions. And the third was interactions between institutions and shocks. In the first one, we saw how shocks went a long way in explaining the evolution of European unemployment, namely the slowdown in total factor productivity growth triggering the increase, and then the variations in real interest rates leading to more unemployment in the 80s and the 90s than would otherwise have been the case. There was still a puzzle at the end of the first lecture, and this is the puzzle we took on in the second lecture, which is that many of these factors which had led to an increase in unemployment in the 70s, the 80s, the early 90s seemed to be going the right way from 1990 on. Namely, people now knew that TFP growth was lower, real interest rates were coming down, yet unemployment was remaining high. And there was this double puzzle: why was unemployment remaining high? And in addition, why was it remaining high in the light of this dramatic decline in the labor share? So this was the motivation for the second lecture. And the argument there was that what had happened was basically that the 90s was a decade in which workers had become weaker in bargaining. And they had given up a lot in wages without getting much of an effect on employment, although the future looked brighter. So a slightly more too optimistic way of putting what we've seen over the first two lectures is that combination of shocks and changes in institutions can roughly explain the time series of average unemployment in Europe since 1970. TFP growth, real interest rates, and then weaker bargaining power of workers. What it doesn't yet explain is the heterogeneity of experiences across countries. And this is the very first graph which I started with, where we saw that some countries that had enormous increases in employment, and they are now coming down, such as Spain, and some countries had remained much lower throughout. This heterogeneity is not explained by anything that I've said so far. And so this, well, it's not explained in the sense that it could have been explained by the fact that these countries had different shocks. So maybe you could say, well, Spain had much higher unemployment because the decrease in factor productivity growth was much larger. When you look at the facts, you find that's not actually the answer, that the shocks which have affected these countries were rather similar in magnitude, and therefore this is not a plausible explanation for differences. And this is what leads to the third lecture, which is the notion that some countries had labor market institutions which were such that when there was an adverse shock, the effect of a shock would be larger or would be longer lasting than in some other countries with different labor market institutions. And that's what I mean by interactions between institutions and shocks. But some countries basically have institutions where the equilibrium rate remains very flat, looks like the US. Some countries it will move a lot. We've seen mostly on the way up, but we now see on the way down in Spain. And therefore, this may be traceable to differences in institutions. So this is the theme of the lecture. Let me make a general remark along the lines of the ones I made in the previous two lectures, which is that there are all kinds of different interactions one could focus on, the effect of unemployment benefits on the nature of the labor market and the effects of shocks, the effect of active labor market policies, and so on. There's no way that in one lecture I can just take this whole set of interactions, and in effect, in each case, you have to look at each institution, each shock, and see how they interact. So I've decided to focus on one labor market institution, which is employment protection. Employment protection, for short, is basically restrictions on the right of firms to lay off workers. These take two forms in practice. Some are financial costs that firms have to pay workers, severance pay, that they have to pay if they want to get rid of workers. In many countries, most of the cost doesn't come from there. It doesn't come from a transfer from the firm to a worker, but for a complex set of administrative steps which have to be taken by the firm, which creates uncertainty, legal costs, and complicates the life of the firm. The difference between the first and the second is in one case it goes to the worker, in the other case it goes to the lawyers, so that we can define it as waste, at least from the point of view of the firms and the workers together. And that's how I'm going to think of employment protection, which is basically a cost, not a transfer, that the firms have to incur if they want to get rid of one worker or many workers. Why have I chosen this? And this will give you a sense of what's coming, is because of two reasons. The first one is that we've made much progress both at the theoretical level and at an empirical level in understanding the effect of employment protection on the nature of the labor market. And the first argument I'll develop is that there's a very strong theoretical presumption and a lot of supporting empirical evidence for the proposition that high employment protection, high costs of laying off workers, state-mandated costs, not offered by the firms themselves, state-mandated costs, lead to a market which is more sclerotic. And what do I mean by more sclerotic? I mean a labor market in which the flows through the market are much smaller. Many less people are laid off. Many less people quit. Many less people are hired. So the flows are much smaller. But the duration of unemployment, which is the average time that people spend in unemployment, is much longer. Now, this totally changes the nature of the labor market. It changes the nature of the individual unemployment experience because it makes unemployment something which happens rarely, but something which is infinitely painful because it typically lasts for a long time. The interesting footnote to this, and we'll see the evidence on this, is that as far as the unemployment rate is concerned, the effect is actually ambiguous because you have two effects at work. You have less people going for unemployment, but each of them staying longer. And unemployment is roughly the product of the two. So that although the two effects are unambiguous, the product of the two effects is ambiguous. And this is why a country like Portugal, which has an infinitely more sclerotic market than the US, does not have a higher unemployment rate than the US. But the conclusion from this is that the unemployment rate as a statistic, as a sufficient statistic for how the market works, is a very bad one. You look at the two numbers, they look the same. In fact, the underlying reality of a labor market is totally different in the US and in Portugal. So on this, I think we really have made a lot of progress. I'll indicate, if I have time, a few puzzles, but I think that there we really know more than we used to. The second part, and that gets to the interactions part, is that there's a good reason to think that in sclerotic markets, the effects of shocks, adverse shocks, say a slowdown in total factor productivity growth, as we saw in lecture one, are likely to have larger and longer lasting effects on unemployment. And here there's an argument which probably dates to, I assume, an argument made by Richard Layard and Steve Nichol, looking at Richard to acknowledge his contribution here, in the late 80s, which relies on the importance of long-term unemployment. And the idea is the following, and I think the idea is very intuitive, and the question is whether we can formalize it and get somewhere. But the idea is the following, which if you have a market which is very sclerotic, namely a market in which the average duration of unemployment, the average duration for an individual is 1 year, then there is going to be a large number of long-term unemployed, large number of people unemployed for more than 1 year. When there is an adverse shock, the proportion of long-term unemployed is going to increase. Right? What is this going to do? Well, it's going to do something if indeed the long-term unemployed are not like the short-term unemployed. They exert, basically, they become nearly irrelevant to the workings of the labor market. They are there, but they are not looking for jobs, or the firms are not willing to hire them, so that although we count them as unemployed, they do not exert any pressure on wages. They are basically irrelevant to the process. So if you have a large mass of people who is irrelevant to the process of wage formation and to the decisions of the firms, then there is going to be no mechanism which is going to make the economy return back to normal after a shock. So that argument focuses very much on the role of a long-term unemployed. If the argument is right, then it is a very tempting explanation, or at least part of the explanation, for why some countries, say Spain, which has very long average duration of unemployment, has had much larger effects of a given shock than a country like the US, in which the average duration of unemployment is between 2 and 3 months, in which long-term unemployment is not an issue. And this might explain why sclerotic markets are not good anyway, but in addition, they have very bad properties when they are affected by shocks. So what I want to do is talk about this, and conclude. Following the same structure as in the previous lectures, let me give you a sense of how the step-by-step lecture is going to go. The first step is going to be to construct a model in which we can think about the effects of employment protection. To do this, we're going to need two ingredients when you think about employment protection. You're going to need, if you want to have the effect that employment protection leads firms to lay off less workers because it's costly to do so, then you have to have an economy in which firms wanted to lay off workers in the first place. So you need, relative to the model of the first lecture, you actually need to introduce these flows of workers, these flows of layoffs in the economy. You have to have a much more dynamic picture of the economy in which at any point in time, there are firms which want to lay off some workers and firms which want to hire some workers. So you have to introduce the flows explicitly. And then you have to make sure, but that comes very naturally, that if it's more costly to lay off workers, then the flow of layoffs is going to be smaller. But the important point conceptually is that instead of thinking of a model of the first lecture, you have to think of an economy in which there are these flows all the time. And employment protection is going to affect their level. So you need a model like this. And then the other thing you may need, and I think you do need, is to capture the notion that employment protection makes workers stronger in bargaining. Why is it? Well, intuitively, because if I want to fire you, I have to pay a very large sum. This gives you some bargaining power, and I'll be more willing to accommodate your wage demands than if I can fire you at will. So what this requires is a model of wage determination, which is not the nearly competitive model that we have in lecture one, but something which has bargaining in it. So the two elements I want is a model in which there are flows of workers, bargaining about wages, and where in the structure of bargaining you have an effect of employment protection which makes the workers stronger, leads them to ask for higher wages, and you want to basically trace the effect. Now, The nice thing here is that maybe one of the directions of research in which there has been the most progress over the last 20 years has been the development of exactly the type of mall that I need. And these are called flow bargaining malls. The history of it is, at a very abstract level, Peter Diamond at MIT started working on this, Dale Mortensen in the US. But here, much of the progress actually has been made by Chris Pissarides, who teaches a course in which he presents these malls at great length here. The only problem with these malls is their complexity, their mathematical complexity. And so what I'm going to try to do, and I hope that I'm successful, is eliminate as much of the mathematical complexity as I can. I think most of it can be stripped away to just get the mechanisms which are important. And I think it will give you the essence of what these malls deliver conceptually without having to go through complicated equations. So having done this, I will present the basic mall, then I will look at the effects of employment protection, showing the effects on flows, on duration, on unemployment, and then I'll take the second set of issues, which is if you have a sclerotic market, what does this imply about long-term unemployment? And if there is long-term unemployment, what is the effect of long-term unemployment on the persistence of shocks? So this is the organization. One more slide before you see algebra. And I think compared to the mall yesterday, which I think was simple in appearance but complex in its mechanisms, this one is actually different in nature in the sense that it helps, I think, visualize the market and understand what's happening. It might be much more intuitive than the one yesterday. So the general view of the economy, which is going to be embodied in the mall, is you have an economy in which jobs are constantly created and other jobs are constantly destroyed. And we're going to be looking at an equilibrium in which the two flows are the same. Why are they created, destroyed? Well, because there are shifts in demands, there are shifts in productivity, so what you are producing today doesn't have customers tomorrow, and so on. Okay. So this is going to create the flows. When the workers lose their jobs, they become unemployed, and they look for new jobs. On the other side, the firms which create new jobs look for workers to fill these jobs, and they post vacancies, and they try to recruit the workers. So you have the workers looking for work, and the jobs and the firms looking for workers. Okay. What's going to happen in an economy like this, as you can see nearly by construction, is that in equilibrium, there's going to be positive unemployment. There are always going to be flows. There are always going to be workers looking for jobs, firms looking for workers, so that there's going to be positive unemployment, positive vacancies, flows of workers in and out of employment, in and out of unemployment. And what we're interested in is what is going to determine the level and the nature of unemployment in this economy. So this is the picture. The way we actually go about characterizing the equilibrium is in four steps. The first one is we have this issue of how is it that workers and firms meet. The workers are looking for jobs, the unemployed are looking for jobs, the firms are looking for the unemployed. How do they find each other? So we have to have a description of that process, which will be the first step. Then having done so, we want to understand what determines the level of job destruction, how many jobs will be destroyed at any instant of time or any period. We want a condition for job creation on the other side. In equilibrium, these two will better be equal. And then we want, and this will be a central equation, we want a characterization of a wage which is going to be set by bargaining. When a worker meets a firm, they have to decide about what wage they agree on. Both of them have bargaining power. The bargaining power is going to determine the wage. And these four conditions together are going to characterize the equilibrium. Okay? So the next step will be a mathematical description of these. Keep the picture in mind so as not to be lost in the algebra. So there are these four parts to them all. The first one is what has been introduced in this literature, which is tremendously useful, which is a matching function. And instead of exactly describing how firms and workers meet each other, having an actual description of it, we basically have a reduced form way of thinking about it, which turns out to be very useful. So suppose that the flow of hires is H. So this is the number of matches, the firms which find workers and decide to work together. Suppose that U is the number of unemployed, unemployment. Normalize the labor force to 1, so this is also the unemployment rate, and we don't have to worry about using one or the other. So there's U unemployed, there are V vacancies. It stands to reason that if there's a lot of unemployed looking and a lot of vacancies, then a lot of them are going to find each other, and therefore there are going to be many matches, many hires. And this is what this equation says. It says that the flow of hires, the number of meetings, is going to be a function of the number of unemployed and the number of vacancies. If there are more vacancies, then it's likely there'll be more hires. If there are more unemployed, then there'll be more matches, more hires. So these are the derivatives. Okay. Now that's very much a black box type of relation that captures all kinds of things. The geography of a labor market, if the jobs are in the north and the workers are in the south, they're not going to find each other easily and so on. It's going to capture skill differences between the jobs and the workers. It's going to capture the intensity of search by the unemployed. If they don't look at all, there are not going to be any hires. So we don't have to explain all this. We just take it as given. It's basically in this function. Now, here comes the algebraic step, which is the most difficult of this lecture, but I hope you will stick with me. It turns out, just for expository purposes, that it's much easier to work with a specific functional form. So h is the square root of z, which is a parameter, times u times v. You can see that's a special case of this, in which there's just one parameter, summarizing how good the hiring is. This has the property that if I were to double the number of unemployed and double the number of vacancies, I would double the number of hires. That's the constant returns assumption, but for a matching function rather than production function. That's reasonable. And so it will be useful in what I do to think of Z as the search intensity of the unemployed, right? You can think of U as the number of unemployed. Suppose that Z is 1, so each of them spends 12 hours a day searching. Now suppose you have the same number of unemployed, but they spend only 6 hours a day searching. Then clearly there are going to be less hires. So Z is basically an index of the can be interpreted as an index of the search intensity of the unemployed. If Z is 0, for example, then if the unemployed are not looking for jobs, there can be all the vacancies you want. The firms are not going to find anybody to hire, and this is what would be implied. Okay, so this will be convenient because if you do a manipulation, you get an expression for the hire, the matching function, which is this, and that's what I need. Define, this is the an important conceptual step again. Define the exit rate of unemployment as the ratio of hires, the flow of hires, to the stock of unemployed. So this is how many people are hired relative to all the ones who are looking for jobs. It's the probability of finding a job. So if XU is very high, very easy to find a job. Okay? Do the same thing for firms, hires divided by vacancies. So if XV is very high, you basically post a vacancy, you find somebody within 5 minutes. Okay? So it reflects the ease with which firms can find workers and the ease with which, workers can find firms, can find jobs, and firms can find workers. Okay. Now, if I multiply, if I square both sides and reorganize, I get this relation. And this relation actually is a useful one to think in terms of. It says, for a given value of z, for a given parameter which summarizes all these things that we don't fully understand, there's an inverse relation between how easy is it for workers to find jobs and how easy is it for firms to find a worker, right? So if XU is very low, so the labor market is very depressed from the point of view of the workers, it takes a very long time if you're unemployed to find a job, then the converse of this is firms have a field day. It's incredibly easy for firms to find the workers. The opposite case is if it's very easy for workers to find vacancies, it must be very hard for vacancies to be filled. And so in this case, it's the firms which have a hard time. And this inverse relation is very useful. You can always think of a labor market as a labor market in which one side is depressed relative to the other, except when the two are equal. And that is going to be useful. So this is a description of matching. And I don't need to say more than that for the time. So it describes how people find each other. Then we want to think about the flows into unemployment and then the flows back from unemployment into employment. So let's talk about the flows to unemployment, job destruction. What determines the flow of layoffs in an economy? Well, it's going to depend on the shocks which affect firms. And I'm going to think of them as idiosyncratic, which is I'm going to assume that they sum to zero. So what happens to one firm is offset by another firm. I don't want to have aggregate shocks here. So at any point in time, you wanted product A, you now want product B. So firm A has to lay off a worker, firm B has to hire a worker. So the amount of job destruction is going to depend on the distribution of these shocks. A very quiet economy may need to destroy very few jobs. People always ask the same thing. A very active economy in which there is a lot of reallocation is going to have a higher layoff rate than the first. The important thing for my purposes, I'm going to take this distribution of shocks in the background, not think about it, is that there is one parameter, and here I go back to employment protection, which is going to be very important, which is C, which is that if there is no cost to firing a worker, then you're not going to hesitate to fire a worker. If the demand goes down, you're just going to do it. Now, if now there is a cost to laying off a worker, you're going to think harder, especially if you think that the change is transitory and you may want the worker later. And so it could be that if the firing cost is very high, you're going to keep workers that you would not have kept had the firing cost been low. So what this implies is that the rate of job destruction, the flow of workers into unemployment, is going to be a decreasing function of the degree of employment protection. The higher the employment protection, the lower the flows. And again, that should be very, very straightforward. We've done one half of them all. The other half is job creation and then wage bargaining. What about job creation? Well, this is an economy which at any point of time, a number of jobs are going to be destroyed because the productivity just went down. We want to make sure that in steady state, an equal number of jobs is created. But firms are going to be willing to create jobs only if the wage is right. If the wage was very high, they would say, we don't create jobs, and the economy would disappear. So there's a condition which says that the wage associated, that the wage that firms are willing to pay workers in a new job must be such that they make zero net profit from creating the job. This is very much the same condition as in the first lecture. For firms to be indifferent to creating a job or not, it has to be that zero net profit is equal to zero, or that the firms cover the user cost. Okay? So it's very much the same relation as before, but there's an additional element here, which is that, and I apologize for the notation here, because C in the first lecture was the user cost, and here it's the employment protection index. Okay? What is different from the first lecture is if firms have to pay high firing costs, then the wage they can afford to pay workers and still break even is lower, right? Because they have to pay firing costs to those they keep, and they keep some people with very low productivity. And so the implication of this is that the feasible wage, or the zero net profit wage, is a decreasing function of employment protection. If there is very high employment protection, the workers will have to accept lower wages if firms are to break even. Okay? So that gives us the wage that firms will be willing to pay. And then there is this last part, which is the, in many ways, the most interesting part, and there has been a lot written on it. We have many ways of thinking about wage bargaining, but I think they more or less give you the same basic conclusions, at least for the purposes of what we're looking at here. Let me first define B as unemployment benefits and think of the unemployed as just consuming unemployment benefits. Okay? Now, think about the firm and the worker who have found each other and have to agree on a wage. And if they don't agree, then the firm has to find another worker, and the worker goes back to unemployment and has to find another job. Okay? What are going to be the costs of not agreeing for the worker? It's going to be a function of unemployment benefits. If they are very high, who cares about becoming unemployed? You'll basically get high consumption, it's fine. The other thing that the workers are going to care about is XU, the probability of finding a job if you're unemployed. If your employer says, look, we can't do business, and if you know that if you don't have this job, you'll find another one in 10 minutes elsewhere, then you don't care much. You're in a very strong bargaining position. So the bargaining strength is going to depend on these two terms. And for the firm, it's going to depend on the corresponding term, which is, well, if we don't agree, I have to fire you. That's costly. So there's a cost C. This is employment protection, right? And in addition, once I've fired you, I have to find somebody else. And that's going to depend on how easy is it is to find a worker, and therefore on XV, the probability of filling a vacancy if I create one. So this is going to strengthen the worker, lead to a higher wage, and this is going to weaken the firm and lead to a lower wage. So I've written the equation in this form, and the details aren't important here. The important thing is what? The wage will be at least equal to unemployment benefits, because why work if there is this utility of leisure if you're paid less than unemployment benefits? And then it's going to depend on XU versus XV. The larger XU, the easier it is for a worker to find another job. The stronger he is in bargaining, the stronger the wage he can get. The larger XV, the stronger the firm is in bargaining, and therefore the lower the wage that it can extract from the worker. It turns out that this really enters as a ratio. It's a relative ease with which you can find a worker, or you can find a job, you can find a firm, which is the important variable. And then C, employment protection, is the effect of employment protection on bargaining, which is that if the workers are protected, then not agreeing and having to lay them off is incredibly costly, and they're going to use this to actually extract a higher wage. And so this is the wage equation. Okay? So we have all the pieces, and from now on it's going to be easier. We have matching, we have job destruction, we have job creation, we have wage bargaining. Okay, and with this, I think I can give you a very intuitive characterization of the equilibrium. Okay. Let's now think of the equilibrium of this economy, given the conditions that I've written. In equilibrium, you can think of the unemployment rate as equal to the flow into unemployment times the average time that people spend there, duration of unemployment. It turns out that duration is just one of the exit rate. If you have a probability, say, of 25% of exiting each month, then your expected duration is the inverse of this, of 4 months. It's going to be convenient to either talk about XU, the exit rate, or the inverse, which is duration, but they're about the same thing. So I just made this example for clarity. If each month you have 3% of the labor force entering unemployment, and they spend an average length of 4 months unemployed, then the unemployment rate for the economy will be 12%. Okay. So this gives a way of thinking about the unemployment rate, which is when I change something, what happens to flows, what happens to duration? Does it go up, does it go down? And then unemployment rate will be the product of the two. And that's how I want you to think about things. Okay? So flows. Well, the flows are going to depend on the layoff rate. If basically it's impossibly expensive to lay off workers, then the flows are going to be very small. Firms are going to keep the workers, not happily, but they are going to do so. So the flows are given by this equation. That's not terribly interesting. What is going to determine the equilibrium duration of unemployment, individual duration of unemployment, or equivalently, its inverse, the exit rate? And basically, conceptually, the condition is that the wage which is set in bargaining must be consistent with the zero net profit wage, or the feasible wage, right? It has to be that the wage that is agreed to is such that firms are not losing money and are willing to basically create jobs. So this is the condition which comes out. The wage set in bargaining must be equal to feasible wage. The wage set in bargaining is B plus of labor market conditions. The feasible wage, what firms can pay and not lose money, is this. And then we can reduce this to one equation. That's the last equation of the lecture. which is that remember that we have from the matching function that xv times xu is equal to z. So I can replace xv by z over xu, and this gives me this equation, in which we have the feasible wage here, and here we have the bargain wage. Now, the square thing there actually has an interpretation, which is that when xu increases, two things happen, and that's why there's a square. The first thing which happens is if xu increases, the exit rate increases, it's easier to get a job if you're unemployed, you're stronger in bargaining, you ask for a higher wage. The other thing is that if xu increases, then it must be that xv decreases. That if it's easier for workers to get a job, it's harder for firms to find a worker, and that works in the same direction. This weakens the firm in bargaining. And so the fact that there's a square reflects these two effects. The fact that workers become stronger, easier to get a job, firms find it more difficult to find a worker, and that's the relation. So once you've done this, you can characterize the equilibrium, which is this. Okay. So you have the wage on this axis. You have the exit rate, xu, on this axis. The feasible wage, w, is a flat line. It doesn't depend on labor market conditions. It's the wage that firms can pay. It depends on c, but c is fixed here, so it's a flat line. Okay. And the bargain wage is an increasing function of the exit rate, which is as the exit rate increases, as it becomes easier for workers to get jobs, they are able to ask for a higher wage, and that's why it's basically upward sloping. Right? The equilibrium has to be such that the bargain wage is equal to feasible wage, and therefore that's the equilibrium exit rate, which is here. Right? This is the exit rate, which is such that workers asked for a wage which is consistent with zero profit. And that gives you the exit rate, and by implication gives you the inverse, which is duration. So that's the equilibrium of them all. This is not incredibly revealing, but becomes much more useful when we actually think about the effects of employment protection. And now we're basically where I want it to be, which is the answer to the first question at the beginning, which is the effects of employment protection on the nature of the labor market. What happens if you increase employment protection? You say now, before that, you could you had to pay 1 month per year of work. Now you have to pay 2 months severance pay for each year of work. So C goes up. Well, there are two effects. The first one is clearly now firms are going to lay off less workers. And therefore, the flows in the labor market, the flows from employment, are going to be reduced. You're going to be stuck with your workers. Once you have them, you're going to keep them more. So the flows are going to come down. Okay. What's going to happen to duration? Why do I look at both? Because remember, the unemployment rate is a product of flows times duration. Right? So what happens to duration, or what happens to the exit rate, which is the inverse? Okay. Well, for two reasons, duration is going to increase. The first one is that if you increase C, you increase the cost of doing business for firms, because now they have to pay firing costs, or they have to keep workers who are very unproductive. So the wage that they can afford is smaller, and therefore workers have to accept this smaller wage. How does it happen? Well, basically by making unemployment more painful. That's a very sad story, but that's the way the equilibrium works here. The way the equilibrium works is the wage that firms can pay is lower. The only way you can get workers to accept this is basically by being weaker in bargaining and by increasing the duration of unemployment. So this is what happens. Okay. And then you have another effect, which is conceptually completely independent. Even if a feasible wage didn't change, the fact that there's employment protection makes the workers stronger in bargaining. They can now ask for higher wages because it would be very costly for the firm to fire them. So at a given, for given labor market conditions, they will ask for a higher wage. But it's no longer an equilibrium. The wage has to go back. And how do you do this? Well, what they gain on one hand by being stronger in bargaining, they have to lose on the other by basically making unemployment more painful. Duration will increase. So on both grounds, and these are separate effects, duration of unemployment, average duration of unemployment, will increase. this is the graph. I mean, there's not probably not much point in showing it, but this is what happens. The initial equilibrium replicating figure one was this one. We were at point A. What happens is two things when you increase employment protection. The feasible wage decreases, right? And the bargain wage at a given labor market condition increases. And therefore, the new equilibrium is here with a smaller exit rate, longer duration. Okay? So Vermeer is absolutely unambiguous about the results, which is that there'll be lower flows and longer duration. So let me now go back to the end of this slide, which it's in the beginning of. Okay. So these are the first two, I think, important results that we get from the theory. In a minute, we'll see that this seems to fit the fact. If you have high employment protection in the labor market, you're going to get lower flows, much less action in the labor market, longer duration of unemployment. That's what we've seen. This is the sense in which I call a market more sclerotic, because it really is just not acting very efficiently. Now, the question is, can we say anything about the effect on the unemployment rate? And as I said earlier, we can't, because the result is the product of the two. There is less flows, longer duration. Can we tell, can we sit down, think about conditions on the distribution of shocks so that it goes one way or the other? The answer is no. So it could well be that you put a very large amount of employment protection, the unemployment rate doesn't go up. The nature of the labor market changes very much, but the unemployment rate doesn't go up. And it's not a sign of health. It's just not the right thing to look at. Right? So that much for the theory. Let me briefly talk about the evidence. What is it that this model suggests you do first? Well, it says take a measure of employment protection. Try to construct an employment protection index for each country, all of the countries, and then look at flows in each country, flows into unemployment in each country, and duration in each country. And thanks to a lot of work by the OECD, we can now do this in a way which is fairly reliable. The OECD has constructed a very careful measure of employment protection in 1999. And they have a database on unemployment duration that you can use to look at flows and duration. So let me show you the results, which are striking and are really not the result of data mining. And are probably too small to be seen in the back, but that's how it goes. So what this does is it looks at, I've forgotten exactly how many countries you can count, but I think 15 OECD countries. And you have the employment index, which is a ranking index, which goes from 1 to 19. Some countries are not there. That's why it goes from 1 to 19. Okay. And what the OECD says is the US has basically nearly no employment protection. So it's here. Then there's a bit more in the UK, but not much more. Then it increases. The countries which have a lot of employment protection, which is very costly to lay off workers, are Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece. And then the other countries are in the middle. Okay. So the first thing plots the employment protection index, and this plots the flow into unemployment monthly. And as you can see, there's a very strong negative relation between the level of employment protection, the degree of employment protection, and the flows. Countries in which there is very little employment protection, the US, Canada, have very, very high flows. Countries which have very high employment protection have very, very low flows, markets in which there is very little action. You may say, well, how much depends on, you know, US and Canada, which might be different. If you take them out, you can see it's not going to change the line of a regression line. It's going to make it less tight, but the result doesn't depend on any particular country. So this is very strong. Now, what about duration and the employment protection index? Well, you can see here that maybe the relation is not quite as good, but it is clearly there, which is as you go from low employment protection to high employment protection, you basically get an increase in unemployment duration. In the US, average duration is around 2 to 3 months. In some countries, it is at the time, for that time period, above 2.5 years. Okay. So you see, basically, the two implications of the theory, I think, can be seen very, very clearly in these two graphs. Then you do what you look at what people had looked at until recently, which was the relation between the employment protection index and the unemployment rate, and you see that there is no relation. And that's exactly the point. You have markets which are totally different, but the effects offset each other, so that if you take the US and Portugal, which I was talking about before, you see that they are totally different in terms of labor market, okay, but they have the same average unemployment rate over the last 15 years. And so the conclusion there is employment protection changes the nature of the labor market very much, but not in a way which shows up in the unemployment rate. Let me now turn to the second part, the second point, which is, well, we've shown that employment protection changes the nature of the labor market. What is the effect of this on the effects of shocks? Is it the case that in Portugal or in Spain, the shocks are going to have much larger, much longer lasting effect? And here, there is, remember the argument, the first part of the argument is that if you have a sclerotic market, long duration of unemployment, there is going to be a large number of long-term unemployed. And these people are not quite the same as the short-term unemployed. So let me start with that and look at the relation between sclerosis of the labor market and long-term unemployment. Okay. So let me start with the evidence, which is what we can do is we can look at the proportion of long-term unemployment in these different countries and see how different it is. And that's what I want to do now. I'm going to do this in two figures. The first one will give you... So what this does is it gives you for each... I've chosen two extreme cases, Portugal and Spain, some intermediate case. And this is not because I'm French. I just forgot to remove it once. Okay, and then the US, which we know is at the other end. Okay. And so what I've done here is plot on this side for each graph the unemployment rate, and on this graph the proportion of people who have been unemployed for more than a year over time series. As you can see, it doesn't always start when you want, but you can get the picture. The important point here is that there's a very, two important points. The first one, there's a very tight relation between the level of the unemployment rate and the proportion of long-term unemployed. When the unemployment rate is high, the proportion of long-term unemployed is higher. Right? That's the fact that all these curves, the thick line, which is the unemployment rate, and the proportion of long-term unemployed, which is the dotted line, really move very much together. What this tells us is basically that most of the action in unemployment is in changes in duration, not changes in flows. So when unemployment increases, duration increases a lot, and therefore long-term unemployment increases a lot. That's the first point. The second point, which is much more relevant for our purposes, is basically the scale, which is if you look at Portugal and at the US, the scale of the variation in unemployment is roughly the same, from 2 to 9 and from 3 to 10. If you look, however, at the scale for long-term unemployment on this side, in the US, long-term unemployment, which is this line, basically goes from 2% of the total unemployment pool to about 12%. So less than, nearly all the time, less than 10% of the people are long-term unemployed. You look at the same graph for Portugal, which has roughly the same average unemployment rate, you see that the scale is that it goes from 30% to 55%. So in Portugal, at the same unemployment rate, there are many more people who are long-term unemployed. Why? Because duration is longer. That's what we saw earlier. So there's a way of doing this, which is even more, I think, convincing and nice, which is to fit these values by those regressions and then plot for each country the proportion of unemployed more than 12 months against the unemployment rate. So this is the same picture as before, but instead of showing you time series, I'm basically showing you a scatter plot. right? So let me just walk you through this. This is the relation between long-term unemployed, unemployment and unemployment in the US. So you can see that as unemployment in the US increases from, say, 4 to 11 during the sample, the proportion of long-term unemployed increases, but you can see that it basically is very, very close to zero. It's just not a big issue, right? Now you look at Portugal, and you look again at 5%. At 5% unemployment, the proportion of long-term unemployment in Portugal is already 35%. When unemployment increases to 10% in Portugal, okay, then this proportion increases from 0.35 to 0.52, a much larger increase. More than half of the unemployed are now long-term unemployed. So you can see why, if we think long-term unemployment is important, the U.S. is not the same country as Portugal. It just has this very large group of long-term unemployed with a larger elasticity. And that's the starting point of the second argument. So let me go back to this. Okay. So this is the point that I've made. This is the point we just saw, which is that at 5% unemployment rate in the US, about 4% of the people, of the unemployed, are long-term unemployed. About 40% of them are long-term unemployed in Portugal. Very different labor market. The next question is, well, what difference does it make? I mean, you know, we could have done women, men, we could have done blonde versus brunette, we could have done all kinds of things. Why look at this? And the answer that the model that I've given until now says it doesn't make any difference, basically. I mean, it's just totally irrelevant. They are long-term unemployed. But in the model that we've written, all the unemployed have the same probability of getting a job. I didn't distinguish between the probability of getting a job depending on how long you've been unemployed. So in the model I've written, this was an interesting thing to look at, but it had no implication for the dynamics of wages for anything. Okay. Now, is this a case of death? No, obviously not. We just say there's something missing from the model that we think should be there, but was not there yet, and we have to think about introducing it. And I think what's missing, or what we think is missing from this argument, is that the long-term unemployed are not the same as the short-term unemployed, and they're not the same because they have been long-term unemployed. Namely, the history of unemployment they have gone through has changed them, right? And that's what we call duration dependence. So step one, yes, there's more long-term unemployment, but to get action, you need duration dependence. So where does duration dependence come from? I think we are learning about this from sociologists and psychologists and economists, and there's plenty of evidence that all this is at work, which is that the long-term unemployed basically give up search fairly quickly because they think there's no chance, so they just don't look. Even if they look, they basically don't know who to ask anymore because their friends are not working and they have lost contact with the workplace, and so they are much less efficient in searching. Then you have these effects, which are different in nature, which is that they lose skills. After 2 years unemployed, you basically have forgotten what you knew how to do, and they lose self-confidence, and that's also very strong from a psychological survey. And this is reinforced by the firms knowing that this may well be the case, so that when they show up, they have found a job, but they have found a vacancy, they come, the firms say, well, we know nothing about you, but you know, our experience is the long-term unemployed are just not very good, and we're going to choose somebody who's short-term unemployed because other things equal, it's better. And so the result is that they tend to be discriminated against in hiring, and this reinforces these effects, because once you know this is going to happen, then you don't apply, and so on and so on. So I think there's no question that duration dependence is very important. And so the last step of this lecture is basically to go from there back to macro. And see how the written lecture gives you actually the algebra and the steps, but the intuition is straight and doesn't need a model. Why is it that duration dependence is going to give us something which goes in the right direction? Well, suppose that we think of duration dependence as a decrease in search intensity, but after a year of unemployment, you basically don't search as hard, say half as hard or one third as hard, right? That's one of the dimensions, but it's easy to think about. Okay. Then the argument is the following. You have an adverse shock, it leads to an increase in duration, the average duration of unemployment for everybody. That's what we've seen. Okay. If there's an increase in average duration, it means that there's going to be an increase in the proportion of long-term unemployed. We saw this for Portugal. So many more people are going to become long-term unemployed. If they search less, and we think of this Z as the average search intensity of the unemployed, then that's going to come down. Maybe a number of unemployed are just not going to be looking very hard. If they don't look very hard, then they are basically not going to count in terms of how the labor market clears. They are not putting any weight on wage setting. And therefore, there's going to be higher equilibrium unemployment than if there was no duration dependence. So duration dependence is a major social problem, but it is also a major economic problem in the sense that it makes it very hard after a shock to return to the initial steady state. These people are out of the market, they're counted as unemployed, but they don't help the market returns to anything. And so you get larger and longer lasting effects of shocks. So in essence, this is the formal argument for why it is that in sclerotic markets, long-term unemployment is important, leads to a decrease in search intensity, leads to some people in effect dropping out, and longer lasting effects of shocks. Given the time constraints, let me just go relatively fast in talking about this, but in the process I'm going to not do justice to one of the weaknesses, I think, of this story as it is. The story is basically logical. You can write down them all with all the steps, and I think I've given you the intuition. How big the effect is going to be is going to depend on how much of a decrease in search intensity the long-term unemployed go through. If clearly some of them just give up, then the effects may be very large. If in fact they keep looking but their chances are reduced by one half, then the effect is going to be smaller. And so for this we need to go to the research, the micro research on hazard rates out of unemployment as a function of duration, which is a big industry in micro labor, but a hard industry because we never know whether it's heterogeneity, unobserved heterogeneity, or duration dependence. Namely, it could be that the probability is always the same, but the best people come out of the pool first. And so what you see is only the bad ones remaining. So on this, in the paper, I go through what I see as the best estimates in the literature, and I'll show you a picture just for the feel of it, which is from a recent French study, which is one of the most careful study in terms both of the quality of the data, controlling for characteristics. And what you find, this is the exit rate as a function of duration. And as you can see, the slope is right, which is that the probability, the different diagrams depend on the treatment of unemployment. Take this one, for example, just for the sake of it. You can see that this is the exit rate, the probability that you get a job, conditional having been unemployed for 1 month, 2 months, and so on, and you can see that it goes down. The bumps come from the times when unemployment benefits are taken off. People tend to be more active the week before, and that's what you see. So there are a few bumps, but it goes down. The question is this enough, if we take this literally, to actually get the kind of magnitudes that we hope to get, say that a shock has three times the effect in Spain that it has in the US? And what I argue in the paper, and you'll have to take my word for it, is that that seems to be too small. So we have a very good story, but given the micro estimates we have, if it is the case that the long-term unemployed still surge quite a bit, then the effect is just not big enough. And at this stage, I see this as one of the open research questions on the agenda. Last slide. What I've argued is we have a story, it makes sense, it goes in the right direction, it may not be strong enough. Are there reasons to think that we could make it stronger by looking more carefully at the various mechanisms? Let me mention three, because I see this as three directions of research at this point, which is that maybe our estimates of duration dependence are not right. That basically it may be that we see the long-term unemployed get jobs, but they get jobs which they keep for a month, and then they are back into unemployment. That we actually don't measure, and there's some evidence that that's the case, in which case thinking that it's easy for them to find a job is misleading. And again, we need the right data for this. We're starting to have them. The second here is an effect for wage determination, which I haven't talked about. I've assumed here that wage determination is the result of bargaining between the employed workers and the firms. Nobody in this economy cares about the long-term unemployed, neither the firms nor the employed workers. So the employed workers in this world do not care about the long-term unemployed, but they care about being long-term unemployed. So it's not that they care about the people, but they realize that these people could be them if they were unlucky. And that puts a lot of wage pressure down when there is long-term unemployment. It is plausible to think that the employed workers do not perceive that risk. But basically, they think of themselves as very, very unlikely to become long-term unemployed. If they do so, then they are going to act on the probability of getting a job when they become unemployed at the beginning, which is still very good. And that's going to put very little pressure on wages. So if they are myopic in this sense, and that is work for psychologists more than for economists, that will do something. The last thing, and that gets me to another direction I had explored, but not further than that in the written lecture, is that here, what happens is that the employed workers care about long-term unemployment because it could happen to them. Well, suppose it could not happen to them. Suppose that the long-term unemployed are not guys who used to be employed. Suppose that they are the new entrants. Suppose they are the youth. Well, in which case, nobody gives a damn about these people. And therefore, the fact that they are long-term unemployed is irrelevant to the currently employed workers because it's not going to happen to them. So this raises the issue of, if in sclerotic markets youth unemployment is very high, which it tends to be, it could be that this also limits the wage pressure because the employed workers are adult more than the young, and also leads to larger effects. Let me end here. What I was trying to convey here is we've made, I think, substantial progress. It's clear in the data that there are these interactions. I think we're getting at some of the stories step by step. But the last sentence, I think, is still an accurate assessment of where we are, which is that at this stage we have more stories than we have proofs. And I've tried to explore one. There are others. I have the sense this is important, but we could do much more. And this will end the third lecture. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to say how much I appreciated the lecture, but actually I have to leave, so I wonder if Richard Layard would chair the discussion, because there's 10 minutes for discussion or something, and 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour as I understand it, so if that's possible, that would help me a lot. And could I say thank you, Olivier, for the whole series and for a very lucid lecture there.
Thank you.
Apparently, the chairman has to start the discussion, so can I just ask you, I mean, my memory is probably completely false, but I thought Austria was an example of a country that had high employment protection, low unemployment, and also low long-term unemployment, but that's logically impossible according to your model, is it?
I don't know where Austria is in the graph that that I showed. It would not be the normal outcome in the absence of other measures. Let me just go back.
I just wondered if that was an impossible
It is not impossible. I mean, you're asking a very good question, obviously, and I wish I knew more about the specifics of Austria. I've been looking at the effects of employment protection in isolation. And so you can think of other measures which would be taken in the labor market which would offset some of these effects. For example, if you combine employment protection with much more active labor market policies, which try to avoid long-term unemployment, then you could achieve another outcome. So this was very much, although I did not explicitly condition on the other policies, this was very much saying, if two countries are alike except in employment protection, in the degree of employment protection, then one will look more like this. But you're absolutely right. I think there's a larger question, which is the eternal question here, which is, are there various ways of arranging the labor market, some with more employment protection and more active policies at some other margin, which give results which are relatively similar, or at least relatively attractive. I don't feel at all I'm at the stage,
some people feel that they are at the stage at which they can answer this question. I feel that I'm still very, very far. Right. I still feel I'm very far from understanding how different systems of institutions can generate results which are equally acceptable. But that's clearly in that direction, the direction of my research. It just seems to me I need to know much more before I get there.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks again for coming on behalf of the LSE.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Okay, who wants to come in here?
Could you give us a rough idea of how the setup of wage bargaining itself could fit in that framework of interactions that you've described, like whether higher or lower coordination in wage bargaining or more or less decentralized rules could affect the outcome?
I think, again, I will admit to insufficient thinking and research on that topic. I have a sense that for the issue at hand, it is largely orthogonal to the issues I was discussing. I think that the additional bargaining power coming from employment protection can manifest itself whether there is decentralized bargaining or bargaining at the national level. So I think that for the issues at hand, this is not an essential element to introducing them all. There's the other question, which is there an interaction between institutions such as the level of collective bargaining and the effects of shocks? And I think the answer on this is yes. And there's a very large amount of work and very good work here, starting with Lars Kaumfors' work, arguing that it should either be totally centralized or totally decentralized, but things in the middle are not so good, to a revisionist view, which is to say that maybe it's not U-shaped, but maybe centralized bargaining is good. I have a sense that there are circumstances in which centralized bargaining is very good. The example of the first lecture, which is the Wassenaar Agreement, which basically required really a deal between three major players at the national level, could not have been achieved without centralized bargaining at that level. That if you have a shock which affects the whole economy, such as a slowdown in productivity growth, then it is probably better to discuss it at the aggregate level than to assume that each little individual bargaining unit is going to get it right. I think coordination in this case is important. I think that's probably true with respect to aggregate shocks. It may be less true with respect to idiosyncratic shocks or sectoral shocks in which decentralized bargaining may be better. But I think there are very rich interactions between the structure of collective bargaining and the effects of shocks. This is a theme which has been there for a long time. In the book by Michael Bruno and Jeff Sachs in the mid-80s, on stagflation was very big on that issue. And I think it could be revisited, although again, there has been quite a bit of work on that.
I mean, just to follow that up, I mean, one of the most striking things, looking utterly casually across European countries, is the relation between unemployment and the size of the country. Do you think that's to do with the feasibility of centralized bargaining?
Trying to do the correlation in my head. You think there's a deep relation?
It was a very strong one.
No, but it's strong, yes, but deep, conceptually deep relation.
I think it may go through that route.
Belgium is a bit of a counterexample.
Yeah. There are counterexamples. They have very bad benefits.
No, but this is a serious counterexample in the sense that the Netherlands now has low unemployment. It had a high unemployment, but Belgium still has high unemployment.
Very bad benefits. Well,
putting something else in the picture.
In the first lecture, there was a question about the connection or the relation between education and unemployment, and I would like to ask a different aspect. There might be a relation between general skills and the duration of unemployment. The more general skills you have, you'll be fitted for more vacancies, and therefore your chance to be unemployed long term will be smaller. What do you think about it?
I think it's a perfectly reasonable hypothesis in which we could actually condition unemployment duration on the education characteristics. Now, this has been done at length, but maybe not exactly in the way you want. And people have estimated equations based on individual data trying to explain unemployment duration as a function of various characteristics. And one of the characteristics typically is the education level. And we know other things equal that maybe surprisingly, right, the probability of getting a job increases with your education level. But I think you're about something slightly different, which is the ability to do more than one thing. And I've never seen anybody try to do that. But it is a plausible idea. We know that there are people who are so specialized that they will never get a job in the same line of work, which implies that they have to accept a very large decrease in the wage, and typically this will take a very long time before they accept it. So there must be some truth to that.
At the beginning of your first lecture, when you presented your macro model, there was an equation in which the higher the rate of unemployment, the lower the wage. Now, what you have said in this lecture, I think, casts some doubt on that in its simplest form. Would you want to revise that to say that perhaps what the wage depends on is not the unemployment rate, but the flow into unemployment? In other words, if there is a high chance of losing your job, even if for a short time, you will tend to accept a lower wage than otherwise. This might be a characteristic of the American economy, for example, where wage growth for individuals rather than households has been rather slow in real terms. So, you know, should we, as it were, go back to the beginning of Lecture 1 and review the precise form of that equation linking unemployment and wages?
Yeah, I plead guilty, but I had a reason. In the first lecture, I didn't want to get into the nitty-gritty of wage bargaining. And I basically went with what, you know, most of us have always used, this intuitive relation that if unemployment is higher, wages will go down or be lower. I think what these models do, and they perform a very useful service, is basically tell us exactly what it is that is going to matter for wages. And indeed, it is not the unemployment rate. Because think of an economy in which unemployment is very high, but the number of hires is very high as well. And the average duration of unemployment is a few months. Then people are not going to worry much about being unemployed, and therefore the wage is not going to respond very much to the level of unemployment. What this suggests is that this is more or less the right variable, which is that if there is bargaining between firms and workers, what workers are going to care about is XU, which is the probability of getting a job if you lose it, and firms are going to care about the probability of finding a worker if they lose it. This you can rewrite, because remember the definition is XU is equal to H over U and XV is equal to V over U. This can be rewritten as V over U. And so many of us have actually in empirical work, including Richard, shifted to wage equations in which it's not just U, but at least U over V. But the point of going into the details of wage bargaining is indeed to realize that the labor market variable, which really matters, is not just the unemployment rate, but much more something like how easy is it to get a job if you're unemployed. But I didn't think it was justified to introduce it in Lecture 1. But you could do it, and not much, you know, of the points I was making would be different.
Well, I haven't warned Olivier that he's going to have to answer further questions over dinner. So I think that we should bring this to a halt at this point. I think this has been a tremendous experience for all of us to see Olivier laying out this tremendous picture over the last 3 days. This is a huge subject, and it's a great experience, I think, to see a great economist piercing through, finding some simplifying models which can actually make sense of this enormous diversity. This is going to be a great book, and I think those of us who invited you to come and give these lectures are really proud to have stimulated it. And thank you very, very much, Olivier.